There's a story of Guru Ram Das, fourth guru of the Sikhs. Masters always test their disciples to see how far they are fit. So he ordered just to raise certain platforms. So all began, all disciples started building those platforms as ordered. Then when they were ready, the master, oh, this is no good, this is not right. Again, throw it away again. Fresh platform to new one. Again they did like that. Where 2, 3, 4, 5 times they did, and they ordered to be just dismantled. Then he said, oh, well, this earth or the mud, what you have used, this is not right. Bring from that place and that building. Then he ordered 4, 5 times like that. You know, this place is no good. Just come on to the other place. There you have to build platform. Well, you see, by and by, people left to it. We are disciples. We are not completely surrendered ourselves to the will of the Master. We just take it what our mind, intellect appeals, what it appeals to our intellect. Then I think Guru Ram Das says that 72 times the platforms were built and dismantled. All others left, he was the only man remaining. People told me, look here, the master has become old. He is not in his right senses. You see, what is the good of just raising these platforms and dismantling? You leave it. And Guru Ram Das was in tears. He said, Master is all wisdom. If he is wisdom is not right, what he says, if I am ordered all through life to build these platforms and dismantle them, my lookout is only to obey the orders, without bringing in any idol. You follow me? This means complete self-surrender. Now, step by step, you judge for yourself where you stand. We want to meet God, yes, very easier, complete self-surrender, everything. When there is no I and no L, then the God is within you. He has not come from outside to enter within you. It is already there. Your I-hood or ego stands in the way. And this ego comes up when you are conscious of the body. Or the physical body, or the astral body, or the causal body. When you rise above the physical body, the physical I-hood is eliminated. Then you got the astral I-hood. When you rise above astral body, you do the astral I-hood. When you rise above causal body, then you will come really understand who you are. Your will is the will of the Lord, and the Lord's will is within you. But all this starts from where? ABC starts from where? To obey the orders of the Master. If he love me, keep me. What does he say? He says, all right, have your life pure. Follow well inwards from outside, within. Rise above body consciousness. Rise above physical body. Come in contact with the God into expression power with the light and sound principle within you. Then rise above astral body, then rise above causal body, and you'll find that the top of your consciousness will be absorbed in all consciousness in the world. You'll find I and my Father are one. Then you can rise further into the super conscious state. This is the ultimate goal we have to come to. The ABC starts from complete self-surrender and implicit obedience of the Master. The God in him, of course. We respect his body because that human pole is blessed that way, that power works, is manifest. And the man who is attached to the outward things or the name or fame, you see, how can he take even one step on the way? So this is what is always enjoined by all masters who came in the past. They come here to bring you back to God. But the people don't pay any attention to them, you see. They simply go to molest them sometimes. So this is what we want, you see. If you want to progress on the way back to God, then you, this is the steps we have to take. First, implicit obedience, what he says. When he rises above body, how will he get you stuck in the physical enjoyments and outward things? You will rise up above them. तो ये प्रेम का खासा भाई देखो हम कहाँ बैठे परसों कुछ और था काल कुछ और था आज कुछ प्रेम बड़ा प्रेम की तारीफ भी क्या हो सकती है नो वर्ड कैन एक्सप्रेस लव कैन बी डिफाइंड इन वर्ड्स कैन यू डिफाइन लव नो इन वर्ड्स यू गिव सम एग्जांपल टू शो व्हाट इज लव And not, you can exactly express the very feelings of your heart. What love is? You may feel, others may feel, see, those who are on the way. It is a subject of soul. Already within us, we have to develop it. This is misconnected, I would say, outside. We have to withdraw from outside and attach ourselves to our controlling power within this body. That's all. What it is. I was just speaking about the chastity of life, which is the most important part of the spiritual life. Spirituality cannot dawn, I would say, on a mind which is driven, attracted to the outgoing faculties, to the outward enjoyments. Out of the five outgoing faculties, eyes, ears, nose, touch, and taste, three are most powerful eyes. Through eyes, lust attacks us. 80%. Through ears, 14%. And through touch, so how to maintain chastity, that's the point. Just control your attention. You see, mind and outgoing faculties derive their power from whom? From us, your soul. And the outward expression of soul is what? Attention. So if our attention is riveted at the center of the soul, in the body, and we may make the best use of the outgoing faculties. For you look somebody, just because you need to be looking at them, even with your open eyes. Somebody might be relating you long stories of vicious things. You just control your attention. You may not be, even with your open ears, you won't hear. So how to maintain chastity, that's the point. You can avoid, I tell you, hearing also. You can live, but you cannot. How can you live? There are brothers, sisters, everybody. You look, everybody. So we derive effects from outside. And wherever our attention goes, we are affected by the radiation of those with whom you come in touch. If they are pure, they're sorry. If not, you got that radiation. So how to be air conditioned, I would say. There's heat outside, there's cold outside. what should we do? We should have air-conditioned rooms. If you become centered within your own self by withdrawing your attention from outside and from the body below even, then you would like to see through this window, you might see at your will, self-centered. You won't have the effects of others. But as we are given up to outward, through the outgoing faculty, to outward attachment, naturally we receive impressions from outside. To be pure, you see, this is the ground on which God manifests. That is why Christ said, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. And he addressed those people who are less yet the dogs. Just quoting, you see. So, how to be above this thing? Tolstoy, Lord, Buddha, Christ, another all saints, masters, they always gave out in their own words this very thing. You must be pure at heart. So unless you be pure in heart, as I told you, just if we, out of the abundance of heart a man speaks, what you see, it is already what you got within you. If your thoughts are within you, you are pure. Then naturally whatever will go out of you through mouth or through radiation, that will have the same effect as any wind which comes striking some fire, touching by some heart, that will be hot. If it comes in touch with the snow, then that will carry cold. Similarly, whatever we speak, whatever we radiate, that carries the effect of our own, what is within us. That is why it is said, man speaks of the abundance of one's heart, you see. How to control? Everybody says, be chaste, observe celibacy, thoughts, etc. And for that, the only criterion I say, I will say, the only specific remedy for that is what? Be self-centered. It is we who give power to the mind. It is we who give power to the outgoing faculty. It is we see is good or bad outside. If we become self-centered, we may make the use of our outgoing faculty, whichever we like. Now we are driven away, attracted by outside things, you see, like anything. So you are self-centered, somebody may touch you. You are not affected. You are air-conditioned. But if you touch those who are not air-conditioned, they will carry effect. So for that, all masters enjoin very strict secularly, don't touch anybody. Don't look into the eyes of others. These are the outward, some precautions, you see, to save you. Just like a tree to be cut, what the branches is, sure no, branches. It is easier to cut the stem. So these are precautions only to cut off branches. But the whole thing will depend on being self-centered. You follow me? What you call here, sotvant. Get your attention centered within you. You are. Outward expression of soul is called attention, or sort. If you become self-centered, you can make use of anything of your outgoing faculty at your own will and pleasure. Now we cannot do that. We are driven like anything. So you are in the world, you see everybody, this and that thing. So only precaution, don't look into the eyes of others, you'll be saved. But still, the main remedy lies there. Specific remedy, I would say, by being air-conditioned, you see. Then you may come in touch with anybody, like a man who is just some incantation man. He lives among the snakes, and snakes don't bite him. And the man who has gotten not that power, then any who will pass between the snakes, they will be poisoned. You follow my point, what I want to bring out to you. So being self-centered is the main thing. That will come up in due course by regular devotion of time to the spiritual practice. By hearing the sound, you are cut off from outside. By seeing the light, you think you are cut off from outside, from the body and the outgoing faculties, even. The more you are successful in doing that all at once, my master, some doctor, came to just examine him. He says, yeah, how you say that you are withdrawn from the body? You see? All right, you examine me if you like, then he becomes self-centered. You couldn't examine him, there no even the blood circulation very slow. So the attention will give life to the body, to everything. This we have forgotten. We are engaged in outward practices, you see, which are concerning the outgoing faculties. You may do for hundreds of years, that carry you good eggs or bad eggs, that will react. But unless you become self-centered, I will again say, you cannot be saved by outward attachment. So main thing, how to be pure? See? Be self-centered. If you want to make use of your eyes, use it, otherwise not. That is the self-centered man, I would say, or he is called a saint. He comes in touch with you, sometimes pats you, sometimes just looks at you mercifully. But that doesn't mean that he is driven by you. He influences others because he is competent. We are influenced by others. That's the beauty. That's a vast difference between a saint and other people. You say, well, he is sitting, he talks to us jolly sometimes. Well, do you mean to say he is attracted by you? Not the least. That allows only to attract others to come on the right way. That's all. So there is a vast difference between a man who is self-centered. Self-centeredness comes only, time factor is necessary. See, Rome was not built in a day. Every saint has his past and every sinner future. These are the things which we have to grasp and make the best use of it. Be self-centered, and for that you must be regular in your practices. All through day you go with your attention centered within you. And so you can use this and that. I learned this secret from Napoleon's life. I've read more than 300 great, great men's life. He is a very self-centered man, I tell you. At night, at about 2 in the morning, he was writing the proceedings of a primary school. Morning was the Waterloo. You see, fight was to take place. You are so self-centered. In the morning at about 8 o'clock in the morning, he's just walking in the corridor. And the minister is there looking, here. What are you after? Sir, it is right at 9 o'clock. Oh, that is at 9 o'clock. It is 8 now. You see how self-centered. So I have been reading biographies of many saints. I have read only 2 subjects. Subjects and biography. We learn something from every man's life. Man is not made great by learning something in his head, you see. It is something what he has brought out in his own life, you see. You follow my point now? Everybody lays great stress on being chaste. Still, with all that, we are not chaste. Reason, atmosphere is poison. The people whom we touch, they are poison. So it is better if you get the company of a good self-centered man. If not, then better leave alone. Only make the best use of the things. That's all. These things are referred to in the books, not given clearly, cut and dried, as I'm just putting before you. You want to be pure, all right, be self-centered, that's all. The diaries will help you as cutting the branches of a tree. Otherwise, they say when a fruit is fallen from the tree or cut off from the tree, taken off, then what is a fruit cannot remain fresh. It can remain fresh so long as it is kept untouched by the hand of man. If it touches, it cannot have its freshness for a longer time. There is one way out. Keep it in honey. That won't be spoiled. The honey is the love of God, love of the Master. In that, that can remain safe, quite fresh, otherwise not. Unless the fruit is touched by the hand of man, you see, it cannot remain fresh. The only way to keep it fresh is to keep it in the honey. Master has given so many examples to bring home these things, and, you see, but simply read through and go on like anything, you see. We should understand, we should see how we can have that very thing in our own lives. Just like two glasses, you may say, of iron, of glasses, any plates or anything which are made of glass, and they are just carried together, they break. You remain touched in a, you naturally by touch, you'll have the same radiation as the other man has got. Unless you have got be self-centered, you cannot avoid the influence of another. So we have to learn swimming in water, or on the dry land. We have to be in the world, yet out of it. And to achieve that success is to be self-centered. You follow my point? So the company of such a person who is like that, you see, that radiation of that life, you are benefited more. Mala Rumi says, if you have a company of a saint like that, only such like saints are referred to in the scriptures, not the so-called saints, the world is overflowing with them, flooded with the so-called saints. Then, if you sit by him for an hour, the effect that you will have by the radiation or by direct attention, you will have more advancement, progress, more effect than by if you put in hundreds of years in devotion. Because once you are sitting by fire, all your cold will go. When you sit by a snowy mountain, naturally you will have cold, all heat will go. So society or the company of the saints is a wonderful thing. Like flowers kept in a room, perfumed. The whole room, but air will be perfumed. They are lying only at one place, by radiation. You keep it in clothes, clothes will be perfumed. If you keep it in water, water will be perfumed. If you keep it on, in the dust, dust will be perfumed. Similarly, where a man is self-centered, you see, is there, the atmosphere is charged. In that atmosphere, you can have very easy understanding, clear-cut things, and also more progress. You get impetus from there by the atmospheric radiation. That is, people run a hundred and thousands of miles to have the company of a saint. And there when we go, what we do? We do not derive the full benefit of the company. Why? Because our whole attention is not riveted in the mind. You will have full benefit.
Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome to the satsang for Master Kirpal Singh. This morning, our reader is Bob Rand Grimes. A Are you there, Barbara?
Yes, I am.
Okay, carry on.
We're continuing on with the biography of Baba Jamal Singh. As you may remember, his master, Swamiji, has passed away. Baba Jamal Singh has now retired from the service, and he retires to his hometown of Guman, which he used to visit quite a bit, because Master Kirpal Singh mentioned that he was very fond of his mother, though he was detached from worldly ties, and that he had known her in three other previous lives, and it was a very good relationship that she was his mother, three other lives previously. So after his retirement, Babaji, on coming to his native village, continued his old habit of going to Bayas Riverside for his sadhanas. The years immediately following the close of his army life were largely spent in this manner, and once, while at Amritsar with Hakim Nand Lal, he mentioned that he was in search of a quiet place in the wilderness where he could settle down and carry on his meditation. Lala Khazan Amal, a moneylender who was also present, suggested that such a place could be found between the villages of Vairaj and Balsaray on the banks of Bayas, where he carried on his business. Babaji, who had already been attached to the area, accepted the suggestion. This was the place where Kahan, a God-intoxicated man, met Babaji in his early life, saying that he was preparing a place for him in the days to come. Meanwhile, Baba Chandra Singh, who too had received instructions at the feet of Swamiji, passed away. In his last moments, Bibi Ruka, a very devoted disciple, asked him what was to become of her. "Fear not, my child," replied the sage. "Another greater than myself shall take care of you." "But where shall I find him, sir?" asked Ruka. "Find him? No, you shall have no need, for he himself will seek you out." Shortly before Babaji came to settle down on the banks of the Bayas, Bibi Ruka was then living at Vairaj and was fairly advanced spiritually, told the villagers that her protector was coming to live there. When Baba Jamal Singh arrived, he found a small hut built out of straw and branches for him, a bare 8 feet by 8 feet, and he began living there. Soon after, Khazan Amal arrived, and hearing that Babaji had come, came to see him. He had the hut plastered with mud and a cave dug out. It was the year 1891, and Babaji gave himself up with redoubled zeal to his spiritual sadhanas. He would enter the cave and stay in it for days on end, sometimes as long as a fortnight, without any thought for food and wrapped in inner samadhi. Though Babaji shunned the public gaze, yet musk cannot be hidden in the dark. He might have no care for earthly name and fame, but name and fame fell to his share in spite of this. Fame of his spiritual greatness had already spread from Guman to the neighboring villages, and going for darshan to a holy man is an ancient institution in this land of the sages. Where there had been wilderness, people began appearing in ever-growing numbers, and regular satsangs began to take place. How could Babaji turn away those who had come to his door? In all simplicity and humility, he taught them the spiritual message that he had received at the feet of Swamiji. Many a moneyed man begged him to be permitted to build bhukha quarters for him, but he, rich in his own humility, continued in his simple, austere ways. To undertake to write the biography of a saint is to attempt the impossible. If it is to do real justice to its subject, it must follow the inner movements that defy observation, analysis, and formulation. You may take up the life of a great artist, writer, soldier, or statesman, and if you are a man of deep understanding and imagination, you may reincarnate it in words, giving a vivid picture of the psychological conflicts and resolutions involved. But the saints, at one leap, have passed from this world to another and have cast their tents in inaccessible realms. Few men have reached there, and those who have entered have been wrapped in silence. When the pen set to picturing this station, it broke in pieces and the page was torn. The study of the progress of the mystic soul is beyond the reach of ordinary mortals, and those who have been on the inner journey can only speak in metaphor and parable, for how else can the language of common humanity be compelled to express experiences for which it was never fashioned? The history, then, of a master soul, as fired by a restless zeal which moves from plane to plane, must remain an unwritten one. At best, it can only give the husk of outer events and happenings to suggest the unusual nature of the spiritual experiences they unfold. And once such a soul has attained full enlightenment and become one with the infinite, its history is no longer its own, but it is the history of those that came under its spell and were liberated from worldly bondage. The story of Babaji's life after his great search had been crowned with success is the story not so much of his own development as of the many souls that benefited from him. Thus, Mian Shiraj Din relates the story of his maternal grandfather, Mistry Elahi Baksh, of whom we have already spoken. Elahi, a childhood friend of Babaji, showed great interest in spiritual matters and would discuss them with him when he, Babaji, would come home on leave from his regiment. Once when Babaji, known in his village as Bai, was in Guman, Elahi saw him approaching in the company of a sadhu. A lively discussion was in progress, and when Elahi wished to know its theme, he was told that the sadhu insisted that Brahman was the highest of all heavens, in spite of the fact that Babaji assured him that there were higher realms. On hearing this, Elahi turned to the sadhu and with solemn conviction said, "Reverend sir, Bai Ji is absolutely right. There are indeed regions higher than those of which you know." This silenced the sadhu and he went away. When the friends were left alone, Babaji thanked Elahi for his friendly intervention and added, "But it is strange that you never told me of your access to the inner spiritual realms." "Whoever said I had access to them?" "Well, then how could you speak with such conviction?" "Oh, Bai, I only know that a man of realization can never utter a falsehood, so how could I doubt what you said?" Babaji was so moved by his friend's spontaneous and deep-rooted faith that he told him, "I shall unlock to you the treasures of which few ever dream and which fewer attain." He took him straight to a nearby pond and initiated him into Surachab Yoga on its bank. However, Elahi had not yet learned the value of the gift he had received. Greatly interested in spiritual questions, he continued the practices taught to him by Muslim fakirs and failed to attend to his friend's instructions. When Babaji came to Guman again, he sent for Elahi and asked him what he had done with the inner key that had been given to him. when Elihi told him that he'd done nothing and even forgotten what he had been told, Babaji was displeased. "I give you the greatest riches that man can ever hope to have, and you treat them with such scant regard?" He scolded and slapped him thrice on the face. As soon as his hands fell upon the repentant Elihi's face, his inner eye was opened, and his spirit rose to higher worlds. From that day onward, Elihi Bax began devoting himself exclusively to the Surat Shabd Yoga and would daily visit his peer or guru and bow in reverence before him. When a great one takes on a wandering soul under his wing, his grace is not confined only to his immediate disciple, but radiates to those near and dear to him. Such a powerful spiritual influence fell upon Elihi Bach's family that in spite of their Muslim relations and brothers' taunts and scorn, many of its members sought instruction at Babaji's feet. Elihi's son-in-law, Hussein Bach, was among those first to take the path. He was very devoted to Babaji and displayed great love and reverence. His guru was pleased with him and treated him and his sons, Ghulam Qadir and Shirajdin, with affection. Mian Shirajdin, in his manuscript account, relates how the Great One would joke with them and receive them at all hours when they were youngsters. Once, when he had gone to Guman and was resting, the boys sought him out there. Biba Daya received them at the door, and when she learned that they'd come for her son, she got a little irritated. "Ugh, when you grow up," she exclaimed, "and have children of your own, never make the mistake of educating them. I'm a mother, and I know all too well from my experience how difficult it is to cope when a son becomes a god." Babaji, at this juncture, called out from within, and the boys went in. He patted them fondly and remarked, "You are always welcome. Do not mind what mother says." A true master is ever with his disciple and protects him not only in life, but equally in death. Nanak tells us, "Nanak, free yourself from worldly companions and seek the friendship of a true saint. They shall forsake you even in life, but he shall not leave you even after death." And from Mulana Rumi, "Take hold, O soul, of one who knows all inner planes, for he shall befriend thee in life as well as in death." To witness the last moments of a disciple of Babaji was to be convinced of his genuine greatness. Countless stories are told of the strange happenings marking the end of those initiated by the Bayas saint. We may quote from the eyewitness account left by Shirajdin in his father's death as an outstanding example. We translate from his Urdu manuscript according to his family's contact with Babaji and some anecdotes he heard from the great master about his own early life. Once Babaji had gone to Guman after collecting his pension. Our father, meanwhile, had passed away. We went to the Great One and related to him the sad news. He consoled us and straightway proceeded to the spot where the dead body lay. On reaching there, he said, "Oh, Hussein Bax, why have you been in such haste? I would have come and you could have had my darshan." As these words were uttered, our dead father opened his eyes and sat up. Our mother, frightened, inquired if anything was the matter. "Nothing," he said. "The master has come, and I am going." He then lay down and was gone. Another very interesting anecdote relates how, while Babaji was visiting the village of Daliwal, Atar Singh, a local inhabitant, carried him across a nearby seasonal stream, swollen with recent rains, and back again. The sage was so pleased with the jat's selfless service that he declared, "O Attar, you've taken me across this little streamlet, and I in return shall take you across the sea of life." He then initiated him into the divine science, and from that day the latter was a changed man. He would take his cattle for grazing as of yore, but on reaching the meadows he would let them go, and himself got busy with his spiritual sadhanas. He no longer used a stick to control his herd, but would manage it with a piece of cloth, and soon became known for his extraordinarily kind treatment of his animals. One day he returned rather early. On reaching home, he told his daughter-in-law, who was there, "Child, get everything done quickly. A storm will soon be here." He then went to take his bath, and on returning, spread a bed on the floor and called all those in the house to his side. He bade them goodbye, explaining, "My time is drawing to a close, and I must soon be gone." Everyone was taken aback at these strange words. How could the speaker talk of dying when he was apparently in good health? At last, his daughter-in-law, collecting herself, asked leave to send for his son. "There's no need," he answered. "My master has come, and I cannot keep him waiting." Saying these words, he lay down, closed his eyes, and his spirit left for its heavenly home. Babaji was not only chary himself of revealing his spiritual riches, but he strictly enjoined his disciples to exercise the same restraint. When they transgressed his instructions, they never escaped chastisement. Thus, Shiraj Din relates the story of a blind Hafiz, a learned man of Dariwal. He once attended a discourse of Babaji at the town of Kapurthala, and when it was over and they were talking to each other, the Hafiz remarked, "The wise have said that he who has read the holy book thrice attains heaven." "Heaven is very far, my dear fellow," replied Babaji. "Those who have entered it alone can tell." The assurance of the sage's voice moved the Hafiz to request instruction. His wish was granted, and he sedulously cultivated the lesson that had been given to him until it bore fruit. He then proceeded to Mian Sahib at Batala, his former teacher, and told him that all he had taught him was a hoax and a lie, and he would often visit the mosque, and intolerant of the pious sham practiced there, he would secretly break the earthen pots and burn the prayer mats. His fellows soon discovered the miscreant and complained to his guru. The blind man was called, and Babaji rebuked him. "Sir," replied his disciple, "I cannot stand hypocrisy, and besides, I am in the right." His master, however, told him that in the future he must learn to contain himself and exercise restraint. But the advice went unheeded, and the Hafiz soon began indulging his whim once again. A group of Muslims came to wait upon the sage and bitterly protested, complaining that he had taught his disciple to turn heathen. At this, Babaji answered, "Does the man still persist in his foolishness? Well, if he will not stop troubling you, do not be angry, for you will soon be rid of him." And sure enough, a few days later, the Hafiz passed away. Similar stories are told about other advanced disciples. A sadhu who came to live at Bayas made rapid headway, and his soul would soar at will to Daswan Dwar. He could not restrain himself, however, and we begin talking of the inner glories to whoever would pass his way. Babaji was upset and told him that he must learn to discipline his tongue. But the sadhu, confident of himself, continued unheeding. The inner curtain was rung down, and for full 16 years he was denied inner access until his very last days, when Babaji's illustrious successor, Baba Sawan Singh, gave him his blessings. Baba Nizamuddin, in a like situation, was to experience a similar check. His son, in a beautifully written Urdu account, narrates how his father, who was the 16th initiate of Babaji, according to the records at Bayat, made very speedy inner progress. In a few months, he had gained great powers and had developed a remarkable clairvoyance. But instead of locking his gifts within himself, as taught by his teacher, he began displaying his spiritual wares and would freely tell those around of future happenings or of what was taking place at distant towns. When Babaji was told of this, he turned to Bibi Ruko and said, "This man has ascended very rapidly indeed, but has not been able to digest what he has got." From that day on, Nizamuddin, who had failed to shutter his lips, found that his inner high had been curtained. His sorrow was great, but trusting the grace of his master, he took to his spiritual practices with redoubled energy. His wife too got initiated, and with the passage of time, great blessings were bestowed upon them, and it was evident to those that came in contact with them that they were no ordinary mortals. But never again did Nizamuddin flaunt his spiritual powers. The entire life of Baba Nizamuddin and his family, as written by his son, is one long saga of the blessings of having a true master. But society is not kind to a living saint, nor to those that are lost in their love. Nizamuddin's devotion to his Sikh peer soon won him animosity of his relatives and Muslim brethren. "He has turned kafir," they said, "and lost no opportunity of abusing and persecuting him." He himself was not to be deterred, and whenever there was any talk of Muslim and non-Muslim, he would recite the Persian couplets. "Love makes no distinction between the infidel and the faithful. Let these words be written on every pulpit and arch. If you wish to go on the inner pilgrimage, then seek an inner guide, be he a Hindu, a Turk, or an Arab." But for all his patience, matters grew only worse, and when things were not to be borne any longer, Babaji advised his beloved disciple to shift his hearth and home to Multan. It was there that he spent the rest of his long life, and would often go to Bayas to meet his master. When, after 1903, he was no more, he would visit Baba Sawan Singh and his spiritual successor, who held him in great esteem. It's not for us to dwell at length on the many blessings bestowed upon him, his sons, grandsons, and great-grandsons. Suffice it to say that the whole family held Babaji in great reverence and, as enjoined by him, kept up all the traditions of their faith while practicing the discipline he had taught. When his wife passed away, she foretold her approaching end a month before the date at which she was in good health. When her hour drew near, she took touching leave of her husband. "I served you to the best of my ability for 60 years. Now, grant me leave for going away. My master and Maharaj Sawan Singh are waiting for me." Nizamuddin asked her to hold his arm and focused his attention inward. The whole family was looking on as the old couple sat wrapped in meditation. 20 minutes later, the husband opened his eyes. "Now you may go," he said, and his wife peacefully passed away. Next morning, when her hearse had to be carried to the burial grounds, some of the relations refused to lift the bier on the ground that the lady was a kafir. But the neighbors knew her to be kind and generous and a true daughter of God, and they helped carry the coffin to the graveyard. Baba Nizamuddin did not tarry long after. His end was similarly known before it came, and when his coffin was to be carried, his brethren's hearts had been softened, and they joined the procession. Many a fakir and sadhu witnessed his burial. As his remains were being lowered, the verse was chanted, "A moment's contact with a saint is worth more than a million austerities." Even to this day, in spite of the division of the country that came with independence, and in spite of the communal hatreds unleashed in its wake, the descendants of Baba Nizamuddin have kept up the faith and often visit Sawan Ashram at Delhi to keep alive their association with the Path of the Masters, or the Sultan Udazkar, as their enlightened forefather called it in the terminology of the Sufi fakirs. That is the end of today's reading. Thank you, Master, for this satsang.
Thank you, Barbara, for the wonderful reading. Excuse me a minute, and I'll do a count. So today we had 72 people at the satsang. Thank you, everyone, for attending. And thank you, Master, for providing this to us. Now please hang up your phone.